Alan, I've gone down these like crazy rabbit holes in the last like 3, 4 weeks, 5 weeks.
Regarding what?
Cooking rabbit holes. Yeah. And it all started with Mapo Tofu.
I was going to ask that. Yeah.
Kind of funny.
Yeah. And so is it all Sichuan or Chinese, or it's just been all kinds of stuff?
No, it's all kinds of stuff. But I like, so I don't really know where to start. But I mean, we talked about Mapo Tofu on the podcast, mm-hmm. and I asked you what it was, and you explained it to me and said that it's like somewhat impenetrable because there's so many, because you have been exposed to a lot of different versions of it, and mm-hmm. and there's so many versions of it when you go and start trying to research it and stuff. So I went down that rabbit hole a little bit. Well, so listener Millie wrote in and, you know, said that it was like a great childhood memory of hers.
Yeah.
And that sort of got me inspired to try it out. And then I did, and I tried a couple of different versions that I found online. The primary sort of source being Chinese Cooking Demystified, but then also, what's it called? Cooking with Lao? No. What is that? There's another YouTube channel. Something with Lao. Yeah, I think that's it. Cooking with Lao.
I can't remember if we mentioned it by name or not. Okay.
Yeah, I don't know if I mentioned it by name either, because maybe I didn't quite remember it at the time. But it's also like a really good channel. It's like this Chinese guy who's been a chef in a Western Chinese restaurant for like years and years. Mm-hmm. And now he's retired, and he and his son make videos about like the restaurant preparations, but then also sort of like their homified versions of some of those restaurant preparations. And like a really cool source too. Like if you want to see sort of like what a comparison between like Western Chinese restaurant cooking is and what, you know, Chinese people might actually cook at home, bearing in mind that they're in North America. So I guess they don't necessarily, like the ingredients that they have access to aren't exactly the same as the ingredients that they would have access to in China.
Right.
So yeah, between that and Chinese Cooking Demystified, it's been like a really good way of sort of like, because also in Chinese Cooking Demystified, they talk a lot about the differences between Chinese cooking in China and what you might be able to do outside of China.
Yes.
Like either in Europe or in North America based on the ingredients that you can get. Mm-hmm. And I found their information to be quite reliable in terms of like, you're probably going to have trouble finding this in North America.
Yes.
That usually means that, at least for me, in Edmonton, it's nearly impossible to get some of the things. Like they use this, obviously, I don't know how to pronounce anything, but I think it's called taizio, and it's a type of oil. It's like a cold pressed, either cold pressed canola or some kind of cold pressed grapeseed oil. I've heard two different versions of what it actually is, and maybe it's both. Maybe it just has to do with the pressing method or something like that.
They always describe it as a quote crude canola oil.
Right.
My understanding. Yeah. They describe it. I'm not sure if you said grapeseed oil, but they describe it as rapeseed oil, right?
Oh, okay. So yeah, I was wondering that. Yeah, I thought that that's what I had potentially heard at one point, but then I thought in another video, and I don't even know if it was them or someone else, but I thought I heard someone call it grape.
Right.
And so like, I thought that I heard them call it rapeseed oil in the, in the first sort of time that I heard it, and I was like, oh, they must mean canola, because that's what we call it.
Right.
But yeah.
Canola is basically a rebranding of rapeseed. But it's actually I believe that the canola that we grow in Canada and mm-hmm. the oil that they're referring to in those videos, I believe that they're both... I'll have to look into this. I think that they're both crosses of two different kinds of brassica, one being rape and one being turnip rapeseed. So they're the same. They're crosses of the same from the same varieties, but they're not technically the same thing. I'll have to look into that. But yeah, it is the traditional cooking medium for Szechuan. Yeah.
Right. Yeah. And then I also heard, and I can't remember which source I got this from, but I also heard that using mustard oil is somewhat comparable.
Oh, is that right? Yeah.
But that's also difficult to find.
Yeah.
So, yeah. So then anyway, I invited Millie and her partner Blair over for dinner to try the Mapo tofu. The one sort of problem there is that Millie is now vegetarian, and so I couldn't really make a traditional version, and I'd never made a version with mushrooms before.
Right.
But I think in cooking with Lau, they said that if you want to make a vegetarian version, mushrooms works like just as well.
Totally.
And
yeah.
So that's what I did. But obviously, mushrooms impart a pretty strong flavor to the dish, mm-hmm. and so you know the flavor profile was quite a bit different. Millie said she liked it, but I somehow doubt that it really, you know, had the nostalgic kick, just right. because it probably tasted quite different. So yeah, that was cool. I don't know, I kind of got ahead of myself, but like I went down this this sort of like research hole with Mapo tofu, and I didn't have a wok at the time. I used to have one a long time ago. I have no idea what happened to it. I think it disappeared in like one of the times that a whole bunch of like my belongings that I had in storage either got like stolen or lost or something.
Okay.
In one of those great purges, I lost the wok that I had a long time ago. Mm-hmm. So I didn't have one. So when I started wanting to try to actually cook Mapo tofu, I was like, okay, well, I'm going to have to get a wok. And so I did, but then I went down this research rabbit hole of figuring out what kind of wok I should buy.
Right.
And mostly what I used for that was Kenji's recommendations.
Okay.
Of which there are several. But then also I was like, once I got a wok that I was happy with, then I was like, well, I really need to know how to sort of like take care of this. So I was watching a bunch of videos on how to season it and how to take care of it and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. To which I had like varying levels of success. I watched a bunch of videos where people get a brand new wok and season it in this way, and it just becomes basically totally nonstick the first time that they use it.
Mm-hmm.
And they demonstrate that by cooking an egg in it and not having it stick.
Okay.
That was not my experience. Mm-hmm. And I tried to be very patient about how I seasoned it and stuff, but it didn't really work out that first time. But since then, I think just after cooking in it quite a bit and cooking a lot of different foods in it with varying levels of oil and things like that, it's gotten quite a bit less sticky.
Right.
So that's good. But then once I had the wok and was like taking care of it, I sort of realized that like, well, I'm just not that comfortable cooking with a wok yet, you know,
okay.
like
okay.
I've never had to do it professionally. You know, like every kitchen I've ever worked in mostly has like there are Asian things on the menu or something like that, but not to the extent that we're cooking, you know, a bunch of Asian food all the time. And so we're not right. really cooking in woks. We're cooking like a component here or there that wind up being done in like a cast iron skillet or, you know, something else.
Right.
I'd cooked a little bit in a wok here and there, like before when I had one. I definitely had one when I was living in BC because I cooked in a wok a few times. But yeah, like aside from cooking at home, like, you know, a few dozen times, I hadn't really had a whole ton of experience cooking in a wok. And I understand how it works and I understand like the benefits of it. I understand that it has like variable heat. You know, as you get towards the center of it, it's going to be like really hot if that's what you want. And then you can sort of move food out of the center, sort of like up the sides to cool things down a little bit and mm-hmm. drop things back into the center that you want to sear or things like that. Like I understand kind of how it works, but I just realized when I started doing it that I didn't have a ton of experience with it and that I wasn't fully comfortable with it. And then I was right. like, well, that's kind of weird because I'm fully comfortable with cooking in a lot of mediums. Like, you know, I'm not at all hesitant to like, you know, pull out my 3-pound cast iron pan and do something that's like that I've never done in it before or something, you know, like I'm just like mm-hmm. totally comfortable with how it feels and like the physics of how the heat work in it and like how to move things around in it and how to flip things in it and things like that. I'm just like totally comfortable with like regular pans or regular like Western pots or things like that, but I just wasn't yep. as comfortable with the wok and I was like, that's dumb. I should get comfortable with the wok. So I started trying to cook like lots of things in it that I wouldn't necessarily normally cook in it. And then I was like, well, I need more dishes that are actually meant to be cooked in a wok.
Right. You started off and you wanted to make mapo tofu, and then you said, okay, but to do that, I need a wok. So you research woks, and then you go, oh, but I need to be more comfortable cooking with the wok. So you research that. And then I assume that at the end of this story is you're going to say, and then I realized I had to learn to speak Chinese. And so that I'm now taking lessons.
Oh man, it hasn't quite gone that far yet. Although, I do, if I'm going to be cooking a lot of Chinese food, and if I, and knowing that, I talk about everything that I cook on a podcast, it's mm-hmm. going to be pretty embarrassing having to pronounce things that I have absolutely no idea how to pronounce on the podcast all the time. So yeah, learning to speak Chinese is probably not a bad idea, or Chinese is not a language.
I know.
Mandarin or Cantonese or their various sub-dialects.
Sorry, I kind of derailed you.
Anyway. Oh my God. Yeah, you derailed me from 30 minutes of catching up about what I've been cooking in the last 3 days. I don't really know what order my story's in. It's definitely not in chronological order. because I had made a version of mapo tofu basically as soon as I got my wok. It was the first thing that I actually cooked in it.
Right. Yeah.
After cooking the first couple of versions of mapo tofu, I was like, well, yeah, I'm not so comfortable, so I should get more comfortable. So then I started watching way more videos on Cooking with Lao and a whole bunch of other Chinese cooking demystified videos and a whole bunch of other, I don't know, wok cooking videos and recipes and things like that. And a bunch of them are Kenji's videos. Because he says several times on his videos that a wok is kind of his favorite tool to use in the kitchen. It's just the amount of diversity in terms of things that you can do in the wok is great. So, and one of those things that the wok is great for is deep frying at home, which turns out that's totally true. And I don't know why I didn't really think of that previously, but deep frying at home, in a pot has always seemed somewhat cumbersome to me. You need so much oil, or having a countertop deep fryer, you need so much oil, but you can deep fry not a huge amount of stuff, but a reasonably small amount of stuff, but for enough for a meal or something in a wok without having to use all that much oil. It gets pretty you get a lot of surface area pretty quickly, and it's deep enough for you to submerge things in. So
okay, yeah,
so it's great for that. And it's also really easy to control the heat in the wok for deep frying. It just works really well. The oil gets hot fast because you don't have to use quite as much, and then you can regulate the heat pretty easily by moving the wok off the heat a little bit or whatever. So that's been great. And I've done a couple things. I made salt and pepper tofu. That's maybe the only thing that I deep fried so far. I was watching a bunch of Kenji's videos, and then, he just put out a book called The Wok, and I was like,
oh, really?
Well, yeah, yeah. In the last 6 months or something, it came out. So he had been working on, so he has a book called The Food Lab. Do you have that? You have a copy of that book, right?
I do. Yeah. Thanks, yeah. Lorena.
Sweet. So I've been, considering getting that book for a long time, but I sort of stopped buying cookbooks for a while because A, they're quite expensive, and B, I don't use them as much as, you would think.
Right.
I mostly do all of my cooking research on the internet, and then I just have enough experience figuring out how I want to approach recipes on my own that I don't often feel like I need a book as a resource.
Right.
Kenji has a lot of really great practical tips, and those are the kinds of things that I really need in a cookbook. I need a reference book for practical tips for doing things in alternative ways, or why things work the way that they do. And there's a lot of information. The Kenji always has a lot of information about that type of thing because he's always doing lots of side-by-sides. Yep. Anyways, I was if I'm going to really do a lot of wok cooking, I should just get Kenji's wok book and just start cooking through it. And then I was kind of sad that I also didn't have a copy of The Food Lab. So I bought a copy of both of those books.
And did it make you happy?
I mean, yeah, kind of. I've been looking at the walkbook. There's a ton of great information in there. I really like Kenji's writing style. It's really funny. He has a really funny foreword in that book where he quote unquote gets all of the walk puns out of the way. And it's like a hilarious paragraph that's written completely in walk puns.
Yes.
That's actually quite clever. So
because I think I mentioned that one of my sources for Mapo Tofu is a blog called The Walks of Life, spelled W-O-K-S.
Yeah, exactly. Every walk blog is definitely titled with some kind of walk pun.
So
then that's sort of and then turns out this story doesn't have an end.
Oh.
No, I just I've been cooking a lot more at home because I've been trying to get more comfortable cooking in a wok. But that's also meant that I've been going down all of these other rabbit holes and watching a ton of cooking videos online and getting inspired to cook things. Like last week, I was starting to get really annoyed that like every video that I watched of Kenji's where he makes a sandwich, he uses shokupan, which is like Japanese white bread.
Oh, okay.
Milk bread, I guess. Japanese milk bread.
Okay.
It's sort of like the most basic bread that most sandwiches are made on in Japan. And he's always like, oh, this is like, you know, the best because it's nice and soft, like white bread, and it has a little bit of sweetness. And but it's still like robust enough that it doesn't just fall apart when you make a sandwich out of it. And I was like, every video I watched, I was like, oh, man, I'm so jealous. I want to be able to, you know, like I can find other bread here that I like whole grain breads or like sourdough and stuff like that, but I just wanted to know what his version of the sandwich tastes like, and there's no place that you can buy shokupan in Edmonton. There are a bunch of milk breads that are available at the Asian grocery stores, but they're sort of a different style, and I don't exactly know what the differences are, but yeah, I guess there's like a Chinese milk bread that they have that's like usually like available for sandwiches at most of the Asian markets here, but it's I don't know, it's just not the same. I don't exactly know how to explain it. It's like more spongy than bouncy or something. Anyway, so yeah, then I went down this rabbit hole of figuring out how to make shokupan, which I baked a loaf of last week so that I can make sandwiches out of it. Thank you, Erica, for the pan.
But then I was like, am I using the right flour? I'm probably not using the same flour as they do in Japan. Honestly, so I went down this rabbit hole. And all this to say that I planted some Japanese wheat.
I almost ordered a pan from Japan this week because Erica lent me a Pullman pan, but it didn't have a lid, and I tried to lid it with like a sheet tray, but that didn't work all that well. Like the sheet tray, you have to weigh it down with something heavy, but it still gets pushed up a little. I mean, yeast is powerful. So it was kind of hard to bake like a perfectly rectangular loaf without actually having a lid for a Pullman pan. And also, North American Pullman pans are like a little, because they're mostly used without the lids to bake loaves that have a domed top.
Yeah.
And so they're mostly like a slightly smaller size than they are in like Japanese or Asian bakeries, because they like make use a lot more of actually making a square loaf of bread. And when you make your loaf of bread actually square, it has to be slightly larger to make a reasonable sandwich out of it. And so I almost ordered a pan or like a loaf pan from Japan this week, but I'm hoping, I don't know. I was going to, but the shipping is so crazy. Like the pan itself is not that expensive, but the shipping is like three times as much as the cost of the pan. So I was like, there's got to be a place in North America where I can find one that the shipping won't be so crazy. So I've decided to hold off until I can do that research. But
if there is a place in North America that has it, surely it's either San Francisco or Vancouver.
Yeah, that's what I was thinking. And I haven't actually found one yet. So, and you know, it might be just as expensive to get it from there, because although the shipping might be better, the pan maybe costs three times as much because they had to already have it shipped from Japan. So yeah, I don't know. We'll see.
Go on a road trip.
I mean, I really want to go to Japan, but
yeah,
that would be the best. I can get all of the things that I need from Japan all in one go. But from
just
what I've
buy
heard,
the bread. Not... Just buy the bread directly.
Just
you don't
go
have
to Japan, get the bread, and come back. And I don't need the pan.
Mm-hmm.
No, but it turns out that that bread is really great. And I don't eat a lot of bread these days, so I'm not going to be like baking a loaf every week. But that was a really nice treat. The bread was amazing, actually.
Cool.
Yeah. Yeah. And then today for breakfast, I made Menemen because that's like this thing that Kenji made on that I watched Kenji make a version of. And then I saw another version pop up on my YouTube. And actually, I found this like really cool YouTube channel. It's like this Turkish woman who cooks Turkish food.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Refika's Kitchen. And Refika, R-E-F-I-K-A. Mm-hmm. And yeah. She makes this version of Menemen that's just crazy. Like the one that I saw on Kenji's channel, that just popped up for me because I was watching all of Kenji's videos. Mm-hmm. And it looked great, but I was like, but then this other one popped up and it looked quite different. The cheese looked like more melty and stuff. And so I watched Rafika's video and I was like, oh my God, that looks amazing. And then I made it for breakfast this morning. It was delicious. Have you ever had Menemen?
I don't even know what it is.
All of the videos that I've watched so far that talk about it compare it to shakshuka.
Okay.
So it's very similar in a way. It's like eggs in tomato sauce, you know?
Yeah.
With I think shakshuka usually has like some greens in it and some herbs and definitely usually has like some kind of like paprika or something, and then you crack eggs into it and you leave them whole.
Mm-hmm.
And you cook them that way, and then you take it out and you can like, and the yolks are still soft and you break them open and you eat it with bread.
Yep.
Menemen is similar. It's like eggs cooked down in tomato sauce, but usually with chilies, not spicy chilies, but
okay,
some kind of chili pepper, and then it has melty cheese, and you stir the egg, like you crack eggs into it, but then you stir them around.
Okay.
So that they are kind of scrambled, and then but then they sort of like hold everything together and mm-hmm. thicken the sauce, and then you eat it with bread. Man, it was really, really delicious. Anyways, Menemen, highly recommend.
Okay.
Rafika's Kitchen, check out that version. It's really good.
Welcome to Food Court. I'm Alan Sutterby, and I'm here with my buddy, Shale McDonald. How are you, Shale?
Great, Alan.
We're two chefs from Edmonton, Alberta, Canada. We love food, and we love to talk about it.
Alan, do you have any follow-up?
I didn't even think about that.
Yeah. I mean, I don't really have any. Well, actually, all of my follow-up I basically dumped into my monologue at the beginning of this episode, which I don't think okay. I'm going to cut out. So,
no, for today, let's say I don't have any follow-up.
Yeah, I don't think that I do either. Although, like, when Millie came over to try Mapo Tofu, we sort of started to get to talking about her growing up in Peace River, like around her family's restaurant.
Okay. Yeah.
But I do think that it would be awesome if Millie were amenable to it to have her on the podcast and talk to her about it.
Cool.
Because we didn't really have, you know, as much time as I would like to like really dive into it. And mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm really curious about her experiences growing up around that kind of stuff.
That would be awesome. Yeah.
Yeah. Millie, if you're down, let me know.
Cool.
She's definitely listening, right? So, Alan, what are we going to talk about?
Well, I just in the last less than a week, actually, got to be involved with two really interesting events. One of them was a class put on by Kevin Kosowin, just north of about an hour or so north of Edmonton around the town of Rochester. And it was about, it was called Food as Medicine, and the featured presenter was a local botanist and herbalist named Robert Rogers. and I got to cook the food at that event. And the other thing that I was in, that got to attend was something called Cook's Camp, which was in Pemberton, British Columbia, and was put on by the Chef's Table Society of BC.
Cool.
And that was also, there's this might end up being two episodes, Shale. loads to talk about. It was so many interesting presentations and yeah. So those are the two things.
Well, yeah. Okay. Well, if you think that there's like two episodes worth of stuff to talk about there, then maybe, yeah, we should break it up. I don't know. Why don't we start talking about, why don't we start talking about food as medicine? And sure. Then see how far we get. And then if we have to turn Cook's Camp into a separate episode, we can do that.
Okay, cool. So there's a man here in Edmonton named Kevin Costwin, who I don't think we've ever mentioned on this show, on the podcast.
I think we may have mentioned Kevin peripherally. Just, I can't remember. I thought that you talked about something about
maybe that, oh, he was talking about, he gave me some game meat one or something. Yeah,
right, yeah.
But anyways, he has a company called From the Wild. Mm-hmm. And it's best known because he makes a web series called From the Wild that has been nominated for a James Beard Award. Right. But focuses on wild food. So there's episodes about foraging and hunting and fishing, and there's always cooking involved. It's oftentimes like in Alberta, sometimes in the boreal, sometimes south in the grasslands, but he's done episodes in BC, like on the coast, and all over the place, actually some in eastern Canada as well. But he started to do I guess you would, I don't know what you call them, they're like cooking classes or foraging classes, and he does them in the wild. He has a bit of land north of the city, like I said, near Rochester. There are some structures, but it's basically like there's a wall tent and a long table and stumps for chairs and a kind of pantry that's built out like with logs. Like it's all kind of semi-permanent structures.
Right.
And people go out, and he's done ones on field cookery, big game cookery, things like that. But he, for this event this past week, invited Robert Rogers to talk about.
So how does it, can you just sort of like for these events, is like he sell tickets to people in the city,
right,
who want to come and learn? And it's like, it's billed as like a, yeah, like a class kind of thing?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So on the From the Wild, like social media and website, he'll announce when new classes are opening. And yeah, just like you said, ticketed event, lots of people from Edmonton, but, people from, different parts of the province and Saskatchewan, places like that.
Is it usually one day or one evening, or do you like people go and stay out there on the land and do stuff over multiple days, or?
As far as I know, all the ones he's done so far, just it's a one day event. So it starts, I think, at 10 in the morning and wraps up by 5 p.m. Yeah.
Gotcha.
So yeah, this one, Robert Rogers is, like I said, botanist and herbalist from Edmonton. He's probably written more books than I've read. loads of books on especially medicinal plants in Western Canada. And he's been around the food scene a little bit. Like I met him at Alberta Mycological Society event, so like the Mushroom Club. And he's given lots of walking tours of the Edmonton River Valley, like Mill Creek Ravine and places like that, just to teach people like what's growing in the city and how you can use it.
Yeah.
So yeah, the structure of this event, we were going to serve 4 courses to these people over the stretch of the entire day. And each course was going to be focused on a certain system of the body. The 4 systems being the endocrine system, the immune system, the cardiovascular, and the nervous system.
Okay.
And so to plan the menu, Robert gave Kevin and I a list of ingredients that he thought best represented like medicinal uses for those systems. And then we planned the menu around that. So for instance, the kind of hors d'oeuvre at the start of the meal was supposed to support the endocrine system. And Robert said that wild caraway and Labrador tea, which grow on site there, were great for it. And he also mentioned things like seaweed and kelp, sarsaparilla and fireweed. And so we had to put together a course using, we don't have to use all of them, but like something composed that uses...
Like sort of heavily like including them so that, you know, theoretically, if you eat it, you're getting the benefits from those plants.
And it gives like when we're serving it, like it it's those are the talking points for Robert. Like he wants to talk about the caraway, the Labrador tea and all that.
Right.
So yeah, it was an interesting concept. Like I've never had that as the basis of a menu writing.
Right. Is it gonna seem weird if I like ask questions about this that are skeptical?
I don't know, a little bit maybe. I don't know, because I don't want to throw shade on someone worked with.
And like I don't want to either. But I also I'm curious as to like whether some of the things, like some of the questions that are going through my head are things that you also were like curious about, and if you had any communication with Robert about those kinds of things, because I would imagine that, you know, in preparation for this kind of thing.
You basically mean about the validity of herbal medicine, right? Like, or some of these.
That's like a blanket way of saying it, but yeah, yeah, like yeah, that's sort of what I mean. I mean, I guess like more specifically, like I would want to, like, if the idea for the meal is to try to give the diner the medicinal benefits of the plants, like I would want to know specifically if some of the medicinal components that exist in the plants are like, you know, volatile to heat, for instance,
right?
You know, are there certain things that need to be like eaten raw in order to get the benefit, or, you know, are there certain things that need to be cooked in order to get the benefit?
Right.
And
yeah, totally.
You know, like those types of things seem like pretty important distinctions to me.
Yeah.
And if that type of thing isn't really known or isn't necessarily taken into account, then it, you know, makes me skeptical that you can actually like just come up with a list of ingredients and cook a meal and that you're going to get the benefit.
So the point of the meal is not to give the participants the benefit, the medicinal benefit of the ingredients. The point
it's to
of
give
the,
them an education about the ingredients.
The point of the meal is to get this man to talk, because there's people who are there who want to hear him. And so these are more like, I know exactly what you mean. And I was wondering about, like, for instance, sure, wild caraway and Labrador tea are good for you, or say good for the endocrine system. But like, if I'm just like, what we ended up doing is curing a piece of salmon and put wild caraway and Labrador tea in the cure, but it's such a small amount. Like, I don't know if that's enough for you to get the benefit, right? Like, it was like,
yeah, that's sort of the other thing that I was wondering too. Like, in what amount do you need to consume this plant in order to get the benefit?
So and, from my perspective as the hired hand in the kitchen, I didn't ask those questions because it really was meant to be more of a, it's the cue for the talking points and to just to get people to taste the ingredient and start thinking about it. So,
that's fair.
So yeah, that first course, we ended up doing, we cured the salmon with juniper was another ingredient that he mentioned. So
cool.
Salmon lightly cured with wild caraway, Labrador tea, and juniper. And we served it on a rice cracker. I used that method that we've talked about a few times now, where you overcook rice, roll it thin, dry it, fry it to puff it.
Fry it, yeah.
I mixed a bunch of kelp powder into it, so it was kind of speckled green. And it was just garnished with pickled shallot and wild onion. But that was the first bite.
Sweet. And the dry and fry method worked out well?
Yes. Although I did have, I think I've mentioned like how finicky that procedure can be. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I had two kind of batches of the rice rolled out drying in a low oven. And one of them I dried just until it was hard throughout. The other one I left for a couple hours longer. And it that one that was taken farther didn't puff at all. It was kind of an experiment. I assumed that the drier it got, the better it would be, but it just straight up didn't work.
Well, definitely it needs to have a specific amount of moisture in it in order for it to puff, because it's the steam that does the puffing. So that's, yeah. And, but I find it interesting that a few hours would make that difference.
Yeah.
But you know, it, as for it to completely not puff, but yeah, that's pretty interesting. Mm-hmm. From what I understand, like 10% moisture is about what you're aiming for.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
How do you measure
that? I don't know how you would ever measure that in like a, in a glass piece of starch that you're drying. But yeah, from what I understand, 10% moisture content is what you're looking for to get that puff.
Like, I wonder if there's a way, this is just overthinking it. You like weigh the cooked rice.
Oh, almost certainly.
And then roll it out. And then I don't know. That doesn't mean
that would be the way to do it. Yeah.
Like, it doesn't necessarily mean that you have to dry it until it's 10% of its original weight. Like, you'd have to, but you'd have to find out what the
moisture content is.
Yeah.
Yeah. Exactly. Yeah. Huh. What the original moisture content is. So, which would probably be quite high for something like rice. Like, I would imagine it would be, you know, at least like 60% or something like that before you dry it. But
you have to, you weigh the raw rice and then you overcook and then you weigh the cooked rice, and presumably all of the gain in mass is moisture, and then you dry it
until
the weight is 1.1 times the weight of the original rice.
The original rice, exactly. Yeah.
I'm getting tired just talking about
this. It's too much. Put it in, just dehydrate like three different versions and see which one fries. That's the,
get Kenji on it.
Yeah, I'm sure Kenji has a blog post all about it.
for the first course, the first proper course, was the immune system, and the ingredients Robert wanted us to work with were mushrooms of any kind. He did mention shaggy parasol in particular, nettle and chaga. And so I made gnocchi that had shaggy parasol powder in it, and it was served in, Kevin had made it. He picks them en masse in late summer.
Sweet.
So it was like, yeah, the gnocchi were kind of like mottled brown and gray kind of by the powder. And then served it in a mushroom cream sauce, that was finished with dried nettle. So it was like splotchy green. And then, yeah, just topped it with more. It was like a mushroom bomb. Topped it with some more, with some oyster mushrooms and crispy speck.
Cool.
So that was tasty. It was a crowd pleaser. Turned out well.
And so you're just like doing most of the prep for this, like at home, I'm assuming, or at like in a kitchen somewhere, and then taking it all out there and just sort of like assembling it and reheating some of the components out there on what, like a gas burner or something?
For this one, because the intent was just, it was almost like a catering event in a way. So all of the prep, as much of the prep as possible, was done beforehand. Yeah, I wasn't making gnocchi out in the bush. But I think some of the classes I'm doing with him in the coming weeks are more like they're cooking classes. Like people are there to learn how to cook in the field. And so that work will have to be done there. And the menu will be written accordingly. Like, we won't put gnocchi on the menu for a field cooking, for a field cooking class. But,
just because you're in the bush doesn't mean you can't have a good meal.
That's true. That's true. Yep.
Just kidding.
But everything was cooked or heated over fire, though. They have, there was like a campfire that some of the food was prepared over. And then they have what they call a rocket stove, but it's like a,
okay.
It's, if you can picture like a column, like a square column made of brick.
Right.
And there's two holes.
Like an oven or a kiln.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But you put the fire at the bottom.
Yeah, and there's two holes, like one on top of the other, near the bottom of the mm-hmm. column. And one of them is the air intake. And one of them you can like feed split wood into.
Yeah.
And yeah, you start a fire in the bottom, put a grate over the top. And yeah, so that's how most of it was cooked or heated.
Cool. Yeah, those things get crazy hot.
Yeah,
so
totally.
That's, yeah.
Oh, and I got to use a wok over it. Actually, that's how we cooked them. It was great for cooking the mushrooms that were put on top of the gnocchi. It was awesome. Just like you get the fire cranked and yeah.
Get that wok as hot as you want.
Yeah. Yeah.
Probably meltingly so if you wanted. yeah, probably like depending on how wide it is, like you probably wind up heating up more of the wok than you would necessarily want to for specifically for wok cooking, but still it's a good.
Yeah, on this one, like the opening of the stove is probably, I'm trying to think now, it's probably only 10 or 12 inches.
Yeah, it's still pretty wide for like a wok heat source, though.
Yeah.
I mean, it still kind of works because the bottom of the wok is closer to the fire and then a lot of the heat escapes like up around the sides of the wok. So it would still be hotter in the center, but
yeah.
Cool.
For the entree, we're doing cardiovascular system and Robert's ingredients were wild onion, hazelnut, hawthorn, and black currant. And
most of that came from your yard, I guess.
The wild onion came from Kevin's yard. The hazelnut was store-bought. Hawthorn, we ended up using... Hawthorn grows all around. We ended up using a product that we found in a health food store, I think. And the black currant was from Kevin's yard. Interestingly, for the hazelnut, I've loved hazelnut for years and years. And like when Lisa and I went to Italy, we like went to hazelnut farms and would like gorge ourselves on hazelnut cake and stuff like that. A few years ago, I noticed that when I ate hazelnuts with the skins on, my throat got a little bit scratchy.
This is a sad story, Alan.
A little bit scratchy. And I was like, oh, it's weird. Is it just like the hazelnut skin is like getting caught in my throat? I don't know. And it started getting a little more intense, but I could still like eat Ferrero Rocher or, you know what I mean? Like if there's like little bits of hazelnut or if it's like skinned and crushed, it didn't seem to matter. I toasted hazelnuts while I was doing the prep and ate a few with the skin on and my throat started to close. I'm allergic to hazelnut. I think
you've developed a hazelnut allergy by eating too many of them.
Maybe,
by gorging yourself on them in an Italian farm.
I didn't like have to go to the hospital or anything, but when I coughed and when I spoke, like there was a very distinct something that it was very much unlike any sensation I've felt before in my throat, but there was definitely something that was closing off and was not good. So
yeah, this is interesting. I know a few people who have developed nut allergies. Mm-hmm. And actually, like for myself, like this doesn't always happen. And like I think sometimes I used to think that sometimes when I would eat nuts, I would get like kind of a scratchy throat afterwards. But I was like, oh, it's because like, you know, I'm eating maybe a whole bunch of nuts and they're kind of like, you know, you chew them, but they're still like kind of sharp pieces. And maybe it's just sort of.
It's abrasive or something.
But like that doesn't really make sense when you think about it, because you're not when you're like feeling like you have a scratchy throat, it's like mostly. Like the reason why you're coughing is because your esophagus feels scratchy and not necessarily, or not your bronchus feels scratchy and not necessarily your esophagus. So that doesn't really make sense. And so I noticed like sometimes if I eat too, like if I'm eating mixed nuts or something, yeah, I'll have sort of like an allergic reaction where my throat starts to feel scratchy afterwards. And so I sort of have to limit my nut intake a little bit. And I don't know, maybe there is a specific nut that's doing it, but yeah, I think that's sort of happening to me too. And that's Sad.
But I'm just worried, like, it's sad.
I mean, one or two and your throat closed up, like, that sounds pretty severe almost, you know? You got to start carrying an EpiPen, Alan.
Yeah. Well, yeah, we do have one at home, but I like
Ferrero
Rocher.
How's that
going to
help you when you're
so
in the bush?
That's true, yeah.
I mean, you can eat all the Ferrero Rochers you want at home and just keep the EpiPen by your side. When you feel the effects starting to kick
I'm
in, just
worried,
stab
like,
that into your leg. And
yeah.
Good.
It, like, even if right now I could eat Ferrero Rocher and not have any issues and just avoid the whole nuts, like, it seems like it's progressing. And so someday I will eat a Ferrero Rocher and it will happen. That's what it feels like. But
yeah. Well, anyways, fingers crossed.
Sad.
Yeah.
So for that course, we just did, we roasted some elk around over the fire and served it with a pesto that had the wild onion and hazelnut in it. And then did some really heavily roasted carrots and onions. And made a little hawthorn puree for the veggies. But
cool. Sorry, what is hawthorn?
Hawthorn is a berry, grows on trees.
Right.
It's
It's
actually kind of hard to, like, it has quite a big pit in it. Mm-hmm. Sorry, the berry itself is rather small. Like, it's like the size of a large grocery store blueberry. But most of its volume is pit. And so to work with it, usually you have to, like, cook it, mash it with a, like, cook it with water, mash it and sieve it.
Speaking of that, I made some choke cherry jelly this week.
Oh, is that right? Cool.
Exactly. Yeah, it's exactly the same process. You, like, have to cook it and then squash as much of the fruit out as you can around the pits and then get the pits out. And
What are you going to do with it?
I don't know. Actually, I'm going to give half of it to my mom because she gave me the choke cherries. They were, like, hanging off a bush that was hanging over the fence into their backyard. Mm-hmm. Not from their neighbor, but from, like, a park that's behind their house. I'm going to give half of it to her. And it's just a small amount. It's only, like, I don't know, it's like probably 2 cups worth or something.
Cool.
2.5 cups. Yeah. Anyway.
So to finish off this meal, for dessert, we were doing the nervous system and the ingredients were pineapple weed. Have you used that before?
No.
It's it grows all over the place. Like, it's everywhere in the city, like, especially around, like, gravel and distressed land and stuff.
What does it look like?
It looks, we should put a picture of it up. It's, leaves are really, it almost looks like, the leaves are almost like yarrow a little bit. Like, it's, like, really like lots of little fronds on it. And then the flower heads are like little yellow, picture little tiny pineapples, Shale. Just like little yellow round flower heads. We'll put a picture of it up. But it's pretty crazy, actually. Like, when you crush them, the flower heads, it smells like pineapple. It's really wild.
Oh, cool.
It's
extra wild. It's not just the normal wild.
Yeah, exactly. I believe it's in the chamomile family. When it's the right, I don't know, ripeness or whatever. Like, you get total pineapple coconut kind of vibes from it. So pineapple weed, sunflower seed, oats, and mint were what Robert had mentioned. And so we ended up serving a pineapple weed pudding with pound cake and a sunflower seed granola.
Cool.
For the pineapple weed pudding, we just, like, when I scalded, like, it was just a stirred custard, like pastry cream, I guess. When I scalded the cream, I just added all the pineapple weed flower heads and it infused pretty well.
Did it taste like pineapple?
Not as strong as if you had actually put pineapple juice. It was more like the aromatics, I guess. Didn't have, like
it smells kind of like pineapple. But
yeah. Like, it doesn't have the acidity.
Mostly like cream.
Yeah, that's right. Like, it.
Right. Okay.
It doesn't taste the same as if you, like, put pineapple juice in the pastry cream, or pineapple puree. So yeah, it's more like the aroma or like the aromatics of it. And then we made a pound cake, and actually I had never worked with or heard of this before, but Kevin had harvested a bunch of catkins from alder trees.
Okay.
And they have a really crazy aroma when they're dried and like pulverized. They smell like to me, lemon verbena, like this really citrusy herbal smell. And we put that, like, flavored the pound cake with that.
From alder.
Yeah, from alder. Green. Yeah. And then
it's interesting because, like, whatchamacallit, sumac is also from the catkin, like the sumac spice is kind of like a catkin from a sumac tree.
Yeah.
But it, you know, doesn't look totally dissimilar from the catkin from like an alder tree or something like that. Mm-hmm. So I wonder if there's like kind of a connection there or something.
I have no idea. Yeah.
Yeah.
I've never...
Because sumac is very citrusy smelling and has a lot of like lemon kind of aromas and flavors.
Yeah, I can't actually picture... Because sumac doesn't grow here. I can't even picture what the... I've only had it as the powder, so I don't even know what the...
Right. Yeah, so what it looks like on the it plant. Does grow in BC. Like when I was living on the coast, some people that I knew had a sumac tree in their front yard, and we used to grab sumac from it. It's just like the catkins when they start to, you know, in the fall when they start to seed and flower or whatever, there's just like these big lumpy kind of catkins that open up off them.
Cool. So with the pudding, the pound cake and the granola, when I tasted it, it tasted good, but it really needed acidity. Like it was all just kind of like mellow, sweet, no punch. Mm-hmm. So I ended up putting a bunch of random fruits from my yard on it. So we had like some dehydrated cherries, some fresh cherries, some poached Hascap, and things like that.
Cool.
And yeah, it was tasty.
Yeah, sounds cool. And then did you have, like, while you were doing that, were you kind of preoccupied or were you able to sort of listen to what was his name? Robert?
Yeah. When he did some excursions, like took the group out, like to walk around and point out plants and talk about what's on the property. I wasn't able to participate in any of those. Actually, generally, I wasn't able to participate. Like I was generally
you were too busy cooking, as in most events that you're catering. Yeah. You don't really have much interaction with the event itself. You have your head down. You're just trying to get enough food in time. Yeah,
I was in earshot, like of the dining table. So I picked up some stuff, but yeah, generally, I was in the kitchen. Yeah,
cool. Yeah, well, that sounds like a lot of fun. Did you like how long ahead did you know that you were going to do that event? Like, did you know a long time ago?
Yeah, a couple months ago, I think.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
We laid out like those, like picking the ingredients and kind of drafting the menu. We did sometime in early August, I think, or
cool
thereabouts.
And did I hear you say that you're going to do some more cooking classes out there with Kevin?
Yeah, I think I'm doing three more this fall.
Cool. And are they all sort of already announced? Able to buy tickets for them right now? Or
if I remember, sometime earlier this week, I think Kevin posted on the From the Wild feed that of all of the classes, there's like two or three spots in one of them that are available. I can't recall what class that was, but yeah, there's not much available.
Cool. Well, I guess if I ever want to go take one of those classes, I'll just have to subscribe to the RSS feed on the website, because I know that my co-host will never tell me ever that he's doing a class with Kevin on Kevin's Land and that I should come and
It didn't even cross my mind that that's something that would interest you. I'm sorry.
I mean, I guess it would depend on what it was, but yeah, I think that that would be a lot of fun.
Yeah,
to go out. I mean, I don't know exactly what the class is geared towards. Like, I don't know if it would just be boring for me to take the class because I already, you know. But I assume that
there's definitely some that
you're
would...
teaching the class, or you know, like that there would be something to be gained there for me.
I think like the ones that remain for this fall, there's field cookery, which is basically just like tips and tricks for cooking at a campsite or in the field.
Right. Over an open fire.
Yeah. And then one on big game cookery. So like specifically like cooking elk, venison,
right,
bison, that kind of thing. But they also do.
And when you do that class, you have to, are you going to break down a part of an animal, or is that like you already have the, you have like a cut of meat that's already been butchered and you're just going to prepare it?
Yeah, I think we'll be working with meat that's already been fabricated. I'm not sure, like one of the kind of tricky things about his classes, even for the ones that are geared towards say like big game and hunting, like he can't actually, like we've talked about before, like he can't actually use wild game in those, like true wild game in those classes.
Right. Because it's illegal to serve it for commercial purposes.
Right.
In
Alberta, yeah, yeah.
Right. Yeah.
I think, yeah. And so it makes it difficult. Like if he wants to do a class on like, say field dressing an animal that's been killed. I think that has to be more like a video that's done. Do you know what I mean? Like he can't really do that in person. Plus the logistics of like,
right,
having,
well, yeah. That's like, that's difficult too, because you need a portion of a carcass that's not frozen, but that is like fresh. And if you want to use wild game for that, it has to have been, it has to have been hunted like very recently.
Right.
So, you know, and that's not necessarily always a guarantee that you're going to find the right piece, right, of.
And for for field dressing, it would have to have been hunted in the last couple of hours or whatever. So that doesn't.
Yeah. Yeah. Exactly.
Yeah. 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 Anyways, that was a bad example. But sorry, I was going to say he has done like spring foraging classes that would probably be up your alley. Like,
oh yeah, totally.
Because it, obviously there is cooking and food to eat there, but like more discussion of like what's growing where we live and what you can find, what you might be able to rustle up in the river valley and stuff like that.
Mm-hmm. Are you going to be doing like, are you going to be helping teach the class, or is Kevin going to be teaching the class and you're just sort of there to like help cook, like to provide like sous chef sort of backup cooking?
There will be portions, like say for the big game cookery, there will be portions that I teach, I think. So like there is a sausage making component and stuff like that.
Oh,
that
cool.
I'll teach. Yeah. Yeah.
Sweet. Well, that's awesome. So how do you feel like it went when you went and did this,
It was
what
really
was it called?
Well,
medicinal.
I think it was called Food as Medicine.
Food as Medicine, yeah.
It was really well received. Like people were very happy with like it's a pleasure to listen to Robert speak. He's got loads of information. People were happy with that. They're happy with the food. It's like it's a really well planned out day. Like it's a beautiful spot. A nice like kind of the way the camp or the property is laid out and is really nice. There's kind of different areas that you move through throughout the day, so you're not just sitting in one place listening to someone. Yeah, it was a lovely day.
And so for you, like what time do you arrive to start like setting up and preparing food and stuff like that?
We were there 8:30 or so. So an hour,
okay,
and a half.
And
before.
The class itself started at 10.
Yeah.
You said?
Yeah.
Cool. And is it like when you arrive, is there wood already cut? Like,
yeah, Kevin has what he calls a wood library.
Okay.
So part of this, that kind of log pantry that I mentioned, he has, I think, 4 or 5 different compartments there that are like fantastic dried split wood organized, yeah, by different by the types
varieties
of tree, which is like a subtlety that I don't know anything about.
Right.
I was just
I don't
jamming
really know
into
anything about it either, but I know that, yeah, it does really make a difference.
Yeah.
And well, I don't know, so there's this in Basque, there's this restaurant called, what is it called?
I can't even.
Asadora Shabari. Yeah. Anyway, when I was traveling in Europe, a friend of mine was staging at Shabari, and a friend of mine who I had worked at NOMA with.
Mm-hmm.
And while I was traveling, I was sort of like in touch with a bunch of people that I had worked with, because they, you know, like we had all kind of like moved on from our stages or whatever we were doing
right.
in Copenhagen. And this friend of mine was working at Echabari, and he told me that I should come by and check it out and eat there. And I had been wanting to eat there for a really long time, because it was featured on an episode of Anthony Bourdain's show. I can't remember which show. I think it's Parts Unknown.
Okay.
But I don't exactly remember. Mm-hmm. But like sort of the whole thing about the restaurant is it's all wood, like food that's cooked over wood.
Right. Yeah.
And the kitchen itself is custom built with all of these grills that can be raised and lowered. And there's just like this fly. So they have a huge oven in the kitchen where they fire the wood that they use to cook the food.
Mm-hmm.
And then each dish is planned around which type of wood they're going to
right.
Cook it over and at what type of heat.
I see. Yeah.
And so in the morning, like what the cooks do and what the stagiaires do and what my friend was doing when he was there, or part of what he was doing. He was also doing a bunch of cooking and stuff as well. But,
mm-hmm.
You know, part of what they would do is like in the morning they would come in and fire all this wood in the oven. And then they would have coals of like five different types of wood. So they would use like I don't even remember like whatever wood is from trees that grow around there.
Right.
But like,
yeah.
And things that they can get from farms. Mm-hmm. So one of the things is like grape vines.
Like the trimmings, yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So like there's lots of dried like wood from grape bushes that gets like cut back every year, mm-hmm. and that all gets bundled up and sent to them. And then like probably I don't even know. Like alder probably is mm-hmm. like a big one, but and apple, I think. Yeah.
Oh, is there,
definitely yeah. apple wood mm-hmm. was one of the ones. Yeah. And then they have all these kinds of wood firing in the oven, and they just sort of like keep that stocked all day or like during the service. And then they take from different parts of the oven, like coals from that type of wood, and put them in, like clean off a spot for them in like the cooking area where there's like these grills that they can raise and lower of different sizes.
Mm-hmm.
And so they'll like put the specific type of wood, like, you know, grape branches or whatever
right, yeah.
under
yeah.
On like the surface, and lower a grill over top of it so that like, you know, the smoke from it is like coming off and hitting the food, and they basically cook all of their food that way.
Mm-hmm.
It's like fascinating.
Yeah, that's cool.
I had a meal there that was like unbelievable. It's I don't know like what that restaurant, like what the deal is with it, with the Michelin guide and stuff like that. I don't remember if it has any stars or anything like that, but it's definitely world famous. And mm-hmm. while I was there eating in the dining room, there were people there from like, there was a couple sitting next to me from Japan that spoke no Spanish, no English.
Right.
They only spoke Japanese. Like they had mm-hmm. clearly flown in for like a couple days to Basque to go to this restaurant
right.
and try it out. And yeah, so it's sort of like in that upper echelon of like fancy restaurants.
Yes.
But like they definitely lean hard into like the flavor of the wood that they're cooking over and the heat that the wood provides, and, mm-hmm. and being able to use that in different ways to prepare like, you know, a fine dining, upper tier fine dining meal. It's
yeah.
pretty fascinating.
Cool.
Yeah. So I imagine that Kevin having all of those different types of wood in his wood library, you know, makes sense. And especially if you got to play around with it a lot. It would be cool to figure out what the differences are in like how hot they burn
yeah.
and how much smoke they give off and what the flavor of that smoke is and mm-hmm. that type of stuff.
What I know from just that brief time that day. So there was alder, birch, pine, and something else that I'm completely forgetting. The pine gets rip roaring hot. That's one thing.
Mm-hmm.
And for smoke production, Kevin said
probably because it burns really fast, right? Because
I think so, because
like softer wood, so it has more like air inside of it or something.
Yeah, or like the red, like it's kind of more resinous, and maybe that makes it.
Oh yeah.
Anyways, Kevin would laugh at me if he heard of this conversation, but
well, we should get him on
someday. For smoking, apparently, so sorry, there's a type of tree called a green alder, but like the green wood from that tree, so like the unaged, undried wood from that is great for smoking, and I think was used, maybe was like important for in indigenous cooking too. But if you like get your coals
that's interesting because I've kind of heard like I think the common perceived wisdom is that like using green wood to smoke things is not good because it has a lot more resinous compounds in it that apparently can be carcinogenic or something like that. But there's like some, I don't know. That's sort of like the prevailing wisdom that I've heard, but you know, like that's just all secondhand information. I'd be curious to see, like play around with the actual effects.
Yeah.
And you can't just burn green wood, I assume. So like you have to like,
It's like
stoke the fire with dry wood and then just put some green wood on it to like make the smoke or
whatever. Exactly.
Which makes sense because dry wood doesn't smoke nearly as much, you know? Cool. So tell me more about like your actual day out there in terms of cooking. Like what, like tell me start to finish. What did you have to do to get the meal to the table? What time did people eat? Like around noon? Was it like a lunch thing?
It was kind of spread out between noon and four. So I think like that snack, the salmon, we served it at noon. And then 12:30, we did that gnocchi course. Sometime around 2:30 we did the elk, and then around 4 we did dessert. And again, for this one, like, because it wasn't a cooking class, it was like a food as medicine class. So I just, because everything is 10 times harder when you're on site like that, especially a remote site like that. I front loaded as much as I possibly could. So like, for that first course, like all I was doing was slicing salmon and building the canapes.
Right.
The gnocchi was obviously like pre-made, shaped and pre-cooked. So, that one, I just got the cream sauce, overheat. And then as soon as it was at a simmer, like added the gnocchi. And then once they were heated through, it was just like plating. And the mushroom garnish was done over the fire on the wok.
When you got there at 8:30, like, was it you and Kevin like stoking the fires and starting a fire in the column stove or whatever?
He started the campfire and the fire like in the rocket stove there. The only like long lead cooking was for that entree. So the vegetables on the
meat or whatever.
Yeah. The vegetables on the elk course, we did, we just took whole onions and put them like in the coals of the campfire, and they stayed there for a few hours. And then once they were like, and turned them every once in a while, but then once the outer layer was like charred black, take them off, push away the burnt parts, and then have the onions. And it's just like really soft, and you can just kind of like pull apart the like little onion petals. And the carrots, I like kind of basically blackened the outside of them over the rocket stove. So that once they were cooked through and we cut them in half, they had like a really vibrant orange interior and then like a blackened crust on them. So that was like a cool, it tasted good, but it was a good color contrast too. And the elk was done over, because they were pretty big roasts, like over low to moderate heat on the rocket stove, like turning them a lot, so they didn't get too crusty on the outside.
Like just directly on the grate.
Kind of jockeying them, so if they just sat right on top of in the center of the grate for the whole time, they would just like char so we had to move them around a lot. And then like the pesto was totally pre-made, the hawthorn puree was totally pre-made, and so it was, when it was time for plating, it was like carve the meat and plate.
And then obviously the components for the dessert were pretty much all pre-made.
Totally 100%, like the pudding, the pound cake, the granola, the fruit, dried and preserved fruit. So it'll be, like I said, it'll be a little bit different when it's actually like a class where people are there to learn to cook. They'll have to be more, it's kind of the same thing. Like if you've done, when you've done like global spots, like spots on, on morning television and stuff,
like you have certain things kind of pre-made, but then you have like the non pre-made version of it. So you can show people how to do it, but it might take too long. So you have to like have a version ready to go.
Right.
So that,
you can't, it's different than catering where like for catering, you can totally do everything in advance, but for TV and classes, you like need an active,
you need to be able to demonstrate
you need
what you're actually doing.
Yes. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. That's cool. How many people was this one for?
There were 16 guests.
Okay. Yeah. So it's like, for an entree, like that's still a fair amount of food. Like, when you said a couple roasts, like I was like, oh, that seems like a lot, but 16 people. That's like, it's a substantial amount of food. And was there was enough space out there to like plate? What was the plateware like?
It's cool. They have in that pantry, they have just like a bunch of kind of like vintage stuff. I think he picked it up at Value Village, like just like old plates would have been at my grandma's house.
Cool. And there's enough room to like put out 16 plates and plate on them.
Yeah,
and
there's a nice long. So the camp kitchen there, there's that sort of pantry that has plates and smallwares and wood. And then there is the rocket stove. And then there's a double sink. That's like, obviously not, it's not connected to water, but you can fill the sinks, for washing dishes. And then there's a long, it's probably almost like, maybe 10 or 12 feet of table, that you can do like for prep and for plating. So there was lots of space.
Cool.
For this,
And is there water available on the property or you have to bring water out?
No, there's no utilities there at all. They brought all the water in.
I wonder, I mean, I wasn't thinking like water from a, like from a municipal system. I was thinking like a well or something.
Oh,
like
right.
That,
apparently there is a spring on the property. I don't know how that works, how you get, I don't know how you get water from it, but he said he has seen a running spring. It's a really there's not even like most of these, a lot of properties like this, even if they're not like hooked up for to the grid or whatever, like there's at least like a kind of access, like a kind of parking, like a something that comes off the road that you could at least drive onto the property. There's not even that. You literally like stop on the side of a gravel road, park your car
and walk
75 yards into the bush to find the camp. Yeah.
That's cool. Yeah. I mean, it's cool. Like 75 yards doesn't seem like very far, but it's a long ways if you have to carry a whole lot of food.
Yeah. It's uphill.
I'm sure there's a good way to do it. Wow, that's pretty cool. And sorry, what's the next one that you were doing was the camp cookery or something, right? Like
I think he calls it field cookery.
Yeah, well, that's neat. Like you said, this is like an episode's worth of stuff. So I feel like if we start trying to talk about Cook's Camp now, this is gonna be like a 3-hour episode. So I don't know, maybe we should just make this one short and sweet.
Thanks for listening to Food Court, a podcast recorded in Edmonton, Alberta, Canada. Food Court is hosted by Alan Sutterby and Shale McDonald. Theme music by Ryan and Shale McDonald. Make sure to subscribe to Food Court in Apple Podcasts, on Spotify, or in your favorite podcast player. We love to hear from our listeners. Please drop us a line at feedback@foodcourt.fm or find us on Instagram at Food Court Podcast. If you want to spread the word, please leave us a review on Apple Podcasts. We'll be back in 2 weeks with a fresh new episode. Thanks for listening.